It's time to unleash your inner cowboy with the Earn Your Spurs podcast. Now here's your host, Alyssa Barnes.
Hello and welcome to episode number 29 of the Earn Your Spurs podcast. I'm your host, Alyssa Barnes. On the episode last week, I talked about the survey that I would love to have you guys complete. And it is still on earnyourspurs.com at earnyourspurs.com/survey. So if you haven't taken that yet, it literally takes like 2 minutes, if that, to complete it. I'm going to be drawing for the Cinch jeans this week. And if you want one, I'll send you a free Earn Your Spurs sticker just for filling it out. I've had some really awesome responses thus far, so I appreciate you guys doing that. I also mentioned in last week's episode, I talked a little bit about Raleigh, North Carolina, and some of the Western activities that are available there. And while I was researching, I ran across a professor at North Carolina State University who studies cowboy culture. And I was actually able to get him on the show today. Dr. Richard Slotta is a professor of history at North Carolina State, and he's taught there since he completed his doctoral work at University of Texas at Austin in 1980. He's born in South Dakota, grew up in the West, lived in Wyoming, California, Oregon, Washington, Colorado, and Texas. And he also served as a Peace Corps volunteer in Panama City, spent 2 years with the 2nd Armored Division at Fort Hood, Texas. His special fun these days is teaching North Carolina study abroad students in London each summer. His 10 published books include Cowboy, the Illustrated History, The Mythical West, The Cowboy Encyclopedia, and Cowboys of the Americas. His work has received awards from the American Library Association Library Journal, the National Cowboy and Western Heritage Museum, and the American Cowboy Culture Association. His current research focuses on human-horse interactions and on the cowboy renaissance, a look at the revival of U.S. cowboy poetry, music, art, popular culture, and more during the past few decades. I talked to a lot of cowboys about modern-day cowboy culture, and today we get to look at a little bit of the history of cowboy culture with someone who has had the good fortune of making a career out of studying cowboys. So without further ado, allow me to introduce you to Dr. Richard Slotta. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today, Rich. I'm really excited to talk to you.
Thank you.
So I talk to a lot of people about modern day cowboy culture, rodeo, what it means to be a cowboy in the 21st century. But you've studied cowboy culture throughout history, so I'm really excited to get your take on the topic.
Good. I've been working at it for about 35 years, so I have a few things to share.
Perfect. So I'd love to just kind of start off by having you tell us about your background and what got you interested in studying cowboy culture to begin with.
Well, I was born in North Dakota, which is right in the western part of the state. It is cowboy culture.
Yeah.
Over the next decades, I lived in 7 different western states. And so it was really the West and Western history that was my undergraduate love. But then I went into the Peace Corps and traveled all over Latin America. And I saw cowboy types all over the place there as well. So I kind of formulated this idea that I could build on my early appreciation and interest in cowboy history and culture, but expand it to both North and South America. And the kind of intellectual hook was that I realized most people have formed their images and assumptions about cowboys based on B-Western movies or Zane Grey novels or popular sources that are entertaining, but frankly not very historical. So I made it my life goal to try to uncover who these men really were, as well as trying to find any women who might be part of their lives as well. And it turns out to be a great research puzzle.
Yeah, I'll bet. And that's really interesting because you're right. So many of us have sort of, you know, we have this image of what the cowboy is all about based on popular culture or popular entertainment, like movies and books, like you mentioned, but how much of that is really accurate, you know?
Well, that was my initial question. And what I also learned was that other countries, Argentina and Mexico and Chile, for example, all have their own mythologies surrounding cowboys. So it was really to deconstruct this mythology and popular culture and strip back to find out, you know, who were the working stiffs on horseback in the 19th century. And happily, that turns out to be possible because unlike our maybe assumptions about cowboys in the Old West, many of them were literate. They kept diaries. Some wrote letters back home to mom, and they would show up in newspapers, sometimes in the arrest records. So piecing together these things and then looking at the records kept by ranch owners, because, of course, ranching was a business and they kept scrupulous business records. So I could see the ebb and flow of demand for cowboy work, came to understand. Of course, they were unemployed long stretches, particularly during the winter. I got intrigued about, well, how do you survive without a paycheck and without a place to live for months at a time, say in Montana?
Right.
So the canvas kept getting bigger. I got a chance to go up to Alberta, Canada, and research Canadian cowboys. To Hawaii, to the Big Island, and research the Paniola, the wonderful, colorful Hawaiian cowboys. And so by comparing their experiences across time and across different geographies, I really got an appreciation of just how adaptable and hardworking you had to be to live this kind of life.
So what were some of the surprising things that you learned that maybe most of us wouldn't know?
Well, I think one is that this whole notion we have of, you know, the cowboy is kind of the rugged individual, you know, in the movies, it's a single guy who takes on the city or the corrupt politicians or whomever. There was a word for the Lone Ranger in the Old West, and that was dead. Because quite frankly, in frontier circumstances, no person could survive by themselves. And so the communal nature of cowboy life, and, you know, when you think about it a little more deeply, it's obvious. I mean, did you ever see a one cowboy roundup? You know, there are dozens or hundreds of cowboys who have to work together to gather a herd in the spring or fall. A trail drive, a one cowboy trail drive? I don't think so. So these were very communal folks. Those lucky enough to have ranch jobs lived together in a bunkhouse. And so there was a real camaraderie among these folks. And cowboys everywhere seemed to be real jokesters. This, again, comes as something of a surprise because our image is kind of the laconic, yes, ma'am, no, ma'am sort of guy. But amongst themselves and out of the purview of strangers, they love to sing bawdy songs and make up rather vulgar poetry. That was part of the artistry of it, some of which has been lost and cleaned up over the years. But we do have some pretty good specimens. So their sense of humor, the fact that quite literally, they put their life on the line for the cattle under their care or for the men they worked with. Very, very loyal folks. So that part of the myth is real.
Yeah. And it's interesting that you mentioned that the communal nature, because I think that that's really still very strong within cowboy cultures. Cowboys, they all sort of stick together. And, you know, when the ranch next door is having a branding, everybody goes. So I like that you mentioned that. That's interesting. What do you think, as far as like, especially now in the modern day, what makes somebody, what drives somebody to want to be a cowboy and sort of to give up the wealth that they might be able to accumulate with another profession, you know, what makes them choose to be a cowboy over that?
Yeah, that's a great question, Lisa. I think that there's no question that this is a lifestyle choice. It's not an economically rational choice, and never has been. Just to start with a historical tidbit, many cowboys of the 19th century were literally boys. They were 12, 13, 14 years old, and they'd go on these Texas cattle drives and end up in Kansas. And so for them, I think one was an element of escape and freedom. And quite a number were escaping farm life. They decided doing that brutal work wasn't what they wanted. So there's always been a kind of romance about horseback existence. We can go all the way back to the knights of medieval times. So I think it's a love of equestrian life that does have an element of freedom to it. You're in the outdoors. There's almost a reverence for nature among cowboys, and the idea that you could spend your workday and your recreation on horseback is just immensely appealing. My most recent research has broadened to human-horse interactions all over the world, and I find this a common pattern that horse people just want to have that life. You might ask, why would somebody raise horses or even cattle in the brutal economic environment we have today? And I think part of it is a love of the land, a love of the lifestyle, and tradition. I know fourth, fifth generation ranch families, and, they would sooner die than sell off the home place.
Yeah, there's a lot of pride involved there, right?
No question. And when you think about the nature of the work, I mean, yes, there's some mechanization and, you can use electronic devices now to mark animals instead of old-time branding if you want. But the reality is it's still a very, very, people against nature kind of survival. And again, that's why people have to work together. Of course, old cowboy life was highly gendered. If a woman wanted to work as a cowhand, and we have records, a few hid their sex. They dressed like men and got hired, but it was overwhelmingly a male occupation. But of course, on small ranches, family ranches, you couldn't afford to be gender stereotyped. Everybody had to pull their weight. And so little boys, little girls, women, men all work together doing whatever had to be done. So that's an interesting change in, if you will, more gender diversity, I think, on today's particularly small ranches.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about the Latin American influence on the American cowboy and sort of where some of our American traditions originated from?
That was really the first, I think, if significant contribution that I made to Western history, which was to point out that we've left out a whole lot of people. I'm part of kind of an 80s cohort, the so-called New Western historians like Patricia Limerick and many others. And we noted that the Western history traditionally was an exclusivist history. Pretty much all you heard about were white men in the case of cowboys, white men on horses. Well, as I began, again, looking at Latin America, I could see all kinds of behaviors, language, equipment, ways of handling cattle and horses that were obviously centuries old and had been imported directly through Mexico and the vaquero. So, if you will, the Anglo cowboys who show up in the 1820s and 30s in Texas and thereafter, they pretty much learned their trade from vaqueros. And so there's this very powerful tradition from Latin America that suffuses the American West. There's many wonderful books, just the ranch vocabulary. You think of rodeo, and caballada, caviard. We take all these Spanish terms and sort of mangle them, and they become part of American culture. Calabosa becomes the calaboose, the jail where Saturday night some cowboys ended up. And so the language and the work life, and I think some of the values get transmitted south to north and actually all the way to Alberta, Canada.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I think there's some maybe subcultures of the cowboy, like the buckaroo, that maybe sort of holds on to those traditions a little bit tighter.
Oh, no question. Particularly in the types of saddles used. So in Hawaii, for example, they do dally roping, just like the vaqueros, because the Hawaiians learned from Spanish California vaqueros who were brought to Hawaii to teach them. In fact, one of my favorite friends in Hawaii is very obviously a dally roper because he's missing his right thumb. He's a little slow on one of the dallies. But yes, in fact, a very good historian and geographer, Terry Jordan, who regrettably is deceased, but he wrote a wonderful book called North American Ranching Frontiers that traces the diffusion of Spanish influence through California, through the buckaroos of the Great Basin in Nevada, and of course up through Texas. So it's very, very prominent. And, you know, I have to be frank, American history has been largely racist and sexist history. And until really my generation of scholars, women, workers, people of color have been ignored or even their history suppressed. So by bringing forth these roots from Mexico and the vaquero of North American ranching, I think we really tried to clarify and make clear that there are very, very powerful continuities and that those have been just ignored or in some cases even suppressed. So I'm very pleased that the modern incarnations of cowboy culture, the great poetry contest, the annual festival in Lubbock, Texas, all of these are celebrating now the diversity of cowboy and ranch life to include Native Americans, vaquero life, women's roles, and many others that have been overlooked.
Yeah, and those all have such a huge influence on what the cowboy is today. So it's important to include all of those. Now, you mentioned that you are really interested in and have been studying human horse interactions throughout history. Can you talk about that?
Yes, it occurred to me, I've been preaching this more inclusive history, particularly with the Spanish-American influences, and then it occurred to me I've totally ignored animals. And, you know, the working bond between a cowboy and his horse is tremendously important. And we see this retained in cutting horse competitions and other equestrian sports, where it's clear that these had work roots, that the animal had to be as much of an active partner in doing the work as the cowboy was. In fact, in reining competitions, you know, basically the cowboy's job is to stay on the horse. It's the horse who's doing the work. So I thought, well, you know, we have new tools now. We know more about animal physiology. There's speculation that animals are much more sensate, not just horses, but dogs and elephants and others, that they feel things that we once ignored. So as one looks particularly at very close relationships, such as in eventing or dressage, I've been happily going to London each summer teaching study abroad students. So I could spend 5 weeks in one of the world's great cities. And it's just absolutely loaded with equestrian imagery and importance. So I got interested in the British roots. There are gigantic chalk drawings that are 3,500 years old in the English countryside of a 500-foot-long horse. I mean, so they've been celebrating for thousands of years this animal. And, you know, when things get to that scale and you see it infused into religion and social practices, you understand this is not just some animal that works for us. This is a companion. So I'm very interested in looking at that. So I'm talking much more to veterinarians, to horse therapists who actually try to rehabilitate special groups with equestrian activities. And I'm becoming much more aware of how powerful and central that that human horse bond is for cowboys and for a lot of other groups, too.
What would you say was the primary role of the horse for the cowboy? I mean, obviously it was a tool and a companion, but how important was that relationship?
Some cowboy cultures are extreme. The first book I did was on gauchos in Argentina, on their cowboy. And gauchos were so single-mindedly equestrian that the records indicate if they had to cross a street, they would get on the horse and ride across the street. They started riding at a very early age, and their legs literally became very seriously bowed around the horse's girth, so that they could hardly walk, because, you know, real cowboys, real gauchos didn't walk, they rode. Well, our cowboys of the American West weren't quite that extreme. But, you know, there is a bow-legged cowboy or two out there, and they
definitely
still had this affection for just being on horseback. I think it's significant that by the 1860s, the first ranch rodeos begin to happen, where cowboys at Ranch X want to compete against those in Ranch Y and see who's the better roper, the better rider, the better saddle bronc rider, and so forth. And so, what do cowboys do for fun? Well, they ride horses. So, you know, and then hence we get trail drives. And it's really very fortunate economically, just as the big open range ranching era was ending in the 1880s in the American West, railroads pushed forward and dude ranching became a major business. So while cowboys, I think, would have rather been herding horses than dudes, you know, it gave them and their lives a way to continue taking dudes on trail drives and, you know, letting them play cowboy for a week or two. So there have been ways in which the cowboy culture and traditions have been perpetuated. You can still be a cowboy today as people were in the 19th century. It's changed, but I think the fundamental values and significance of what they're doing has remained much the same.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, there's still ranches out there. They're still raising cattle. They still need cowboys to take care of them. And so that I definitely agree with you. There's certainly that element is still alive, but it really has evolved as well, because there's so many people that have horses and they want to sort of experience that lifestyle, but they probably have a day job where, you know, rather than having that as their primary income or their primary career. So what do you attribute that to? Why are people so fascinated with the cowboy, and what has sort of created this cowboy renaissance, as you say?
Well, the one reality that hasn't changed is it's not a career, if you define that as something that will finance you and your family. Every few years, a major polling organization looks at the 250 different job descriptions. And in the last 20 years, being a cowboy has ranked in the bottom five of 250 every time, along with being a coal miner and doing some other dangerous, low-paying things. So, you know, behind every working cowboy is a wife with a good job, because it is much more of a hobby and a lifestyle choice than a way to make a living. And that really hasn't changed. And I think part of that is just global economics. You know, beef isn't cheap, but with multiple places now where beef can be imported, there's just global competition and it's kept wages low. So that gets us back to why would people do this? And again, I think, and this runs across the cultures, I guess I've studied cowboys in about 10 different countries. And in every case, this is something that they want to do above all else. which again brings us back to that human horse bond. You know, this just isn't a job. This is a way of living that is so significant to some people they will undergo physical discomfort and distress, injuries. Take it to the next level. Rodeo cowboys, they're in danger every time that they compete, practically. So all of that says that this is much more powerful than someone deciding, I'm going to be a third grade teacher or be a dentist. Okay,
right.
Those are callings that I'm sure some people have a powerful affinity for, but I think qualitatively, the equestrian bond is just far, far greater and stronger.
Do you think there's anything that people, any sort of character that people are born with that sort of predisposes them to want to pursue that? Or, you know, is it something in somebody's personality? Or I'm curious, like,
that's a great question. And even with MRIs and genome sequencing, nobody's found a cowboy gene so far that I'm aware of. But I'm sure people are looking. I have a hunch it has much more to do with one of two possible sources. One is, if you will, conditioning and experience. People who grow up in ranch communities, young people do one of two things. They either embrace the life and the love of the land and continue, or they flee in horror. You know, I mean, this just isn't a choice that every young person's going to make. But of course, the other is still popular culture. The cowboy is still a romanticized figure. You know, unlike the 1960s, two-thirds of popular television programs are not Westerns as they were back then. So in terms of overall importance in popular culture, the Western has slid down very far. But there's still these romantic little shots. And I think in the 19th century, Easterners would sometimes see an article by Frederick Remington with his wonderful drawings, or they would see paintings by Charlie Russell. And that kind of romantic attachment that we saw through the media of the 19th century is replicated today in everything from bull riding to the occasional Western movies that come out. And still, there's a significant, I'm a proud member of the Western Writers of America, and there is a large body of people doing very creative, wonderful fiction and nonfiction about the American West.
Yeah, it would sure be interesting if we could uncover that cowboy gene, huh?
Well, that's, I have colleagues at my university, North Carolina State, who do that sort of thing, but I think I'll leave it to them.
So, you know, even in the 21st century, even with all of our modern technology and, you know, so many people living in urban areas, dude ranches are still really popular. Cowboy poetry gatherings, Western festivals. It seems like people in the city, a lot of them really want to get out and sort of get in touch with these cowboy roots, if you will. Has that sort of increased in recent years, would you say?
Oh, no question. In fact, about 10 minutes ago, before I rode off the trail, you asked me about the cowboy renaissance. And that's what I think of it. Since the early 1980s, with the first poetry gathering in Elko, Nevada, this brought to national attention a phenomenon that had been going on for much of the 20th century. Another surprising thing about cowboys is that they're very poetic and very musical. And people had been writing cowboy poetry and cowgirl poetry for the whole 20th century, but only sharing it with a few family and friends. And so since Elko, we've had the proliferation of public manifestations of cowboy culture. So the same thing happening in the Native American communities with powwows. So I think a powerful driver here is nostalgia. Most of us are urban, either in where we live or where we work. We've lost any real connection with the land. There's a wonderful form of literature called tellurism, in which the land becomes a kind of a living entity, that it has almost a mystical hold on people. And while this is fictional literature, I think this power of the land is real. And so this is a way for people who maybe, you know, bought their first pair of cowboy boots last week. You know, they can go to Elko or Durango or Lubbock or Fort Worth or dozens of other places and hear real working cowboys singing, reciting poems. My favorites are the cowgirl poets, because they bring such a different and interesting perspective to what's going on, and often rather pointed humor. but in the same way, I used women's letters in the 19th century, because they're out in the ranching frontiers, but they have a very different perspective, because you know, they have to hold the family together. They have to be mindful of paying the bills, usually. And so this recreation of cowboy culture, again, what I call the Renaissance, is showing me two things. One, that some of these 19th century values and concerns are still very real in America's ranch culture, today. And then secondly, we have, again, more mythologized kinds of additions, projections of the good old days and how wonderful it must have been. Well, you know, not if you're freezing in a snowdrift somewhere. So we still tend to over-romanticize it. But I think that's because people who love this life love it so dearly. And, you know, it's selective memory. They remember the good times, and those bad ones just kind of drift away.
Yeah. And they wouldn't have it any other way. So, you know.
Precisely. Good point.
That's just, that is so interesting. It's been really great talking to you, and you know, it's, your perspective is not one that I get to hear a lot of, and, you know, hearing about the cowboy throughout history, it's great. So thank you for being here. If people want to learn more about you, check out your books, where can they find you?
Probably quickest and entree point is my website, which is cowboyprof, all one word, cowboyprof.com. And that has a number of short articles that are readily available, links to my books. You may want to look in libraries to find books. I'd love to sell some more, but several are out of print. So they're only available through booksellers, used booksellers, or libraries. The two that are probably most accessible, and that I know might be available, one is the Cowboy Encyclopedia, which has short entries on several hundred topics. And the other, if people are more interested in the Hispanic roots and so on, that book is Cowboys of the Americas, that Yale University Press published. But I try to get back west and give a few lectures. I'll be out in Fort Worth next spring to... we're doing a 25th anniversary commemoration of Lonesome Dove, one of my all-time favorites. So that'll be in April 2016 in Fort Worth. So I'll again talk about the Hispanic roots and talk about some Latin American cattle drives and some across the lava flows in Hawaii that are a little different from what we think of as cattle drives.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I also, of course, love Lonesome Dove. I mean, we could have a whole 30-minute conversation on that alone, probably.
Well, I'll bring you some names of folks who can help you out for future interviews, because they're bringing in about six of us to talk about various aspects of both the film, but also the history that it represents. And I think it'll be a really fun event.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's probably a lot of diehard Lonesome Dove fans out there that'll love to attend that event.
No question.
And Gus McRae fans, of course.
Indeed. in fact, I said earlier that I'm trying to sort of correct some of the mythologies of Western history, but there are some people like Charlie Goodnight and other figures who just loom so large that frankly, they're mythical, but it's real. They're that important. So those myths I don't want to disturb at all.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm sure you could just break down so many different stories and movies that we've all seen throughout the years and tell us, you know, what's actually real and what's not. That would be really interesting to know.
The popular culture parts, again, it's much like examining the myths. I did a book a few years ago called The Mythical West, where I looked at about 150 different myths and tried to see what were the historical roots, if any. And so you're absolutely right that many of these popular culture depictions, I admire Lonesome Dove so much because somebody did their homework. I mean, they looked at everything from the equipment and dress to how they would dress the herd in various circumstances to the nature of the little towns. I guess the one criticism I'd have, the Native Americans in Lonesome Dove are not upstanding citizens. I mean, Blue Duck is sometimes unequivocally evil as you can get. So that part of it, I think, is not accurate. But so I love looking at novels, movies, even poetry, and trying to see, can we extract some historical reality from these things? And then why would these other things be added in? So, it's a full-time job, I'm happy to say.
Well, it doesn't sound like a bad one to me.
No, me neither.
Pretty interesting to be able to research cowboys all day.
Well, my wife, who's an academic sociologist, we've been married for more than 30 years, and she still can't introduce me in polite company without bursting into laughter when she says he studies cowboys. So, but I don't take it to heart. If somebody will pay me to do this, I just thank my part of the economy and the culture that makes it possible.
Absolutely. I mean, I would think there's probably a lot of people out there that would like to have your job.
Well, I will say a few little magical moments. Got to meet and shake hands with Gene Autry back in the 90s, with Herb Jeffries, and have a private concert. He was the bronze buckaroo. He made black westerns, the only ones, black cowboy hero of the 1930s. In Cody, I got to don one of Buffalo Bill Cody's buckskin jackets from the 19th century. But don't tell anybody. I don't think the curator is supposed to let me do that. I count Michael Martin Murphy, who was the leading songster of the cowboy musical revival, as a friend. And in fact, I've helped him research some historical cowboy songs. So I've had the opportunity to meet and work with just some of the most wonderful people one could ever imagine. And at the end of the month, there's a paycheck. So can't really complain.
That's not too bad. Did you ever have a chance to meet Casey Tibbs?
That I did not. I helped propose a museum in his honor, which I believe is opened in South Dakota.
Yeah.
I whenever anyone's looking for grant money, they try to find me because I don't have money, but I have academic credentials that help make a sale. So I did work on the museum in his honor. There are just a long line. Andy Wilkerson in Texas, who is a relative of Charlie Goodnight, has been a joy to work with. And so I love going. If I had a better travel budget, I'd be going to every cowboy poetry gathering I could and interviewing everybody I could to get their stories about, you know, how did they get interested? What does this mean to them? If they're a young young scholars and writers out in the West start snagging these people and getting their stories.
Well, that's interesting that you mentioned that, because I just put out a survey to my audience recently, and I was reading through some of the responses last night, and one of them, I gave them some space to just tell me about themselves, and one of them was from an 11-year-old cowboy poet who was telling me, you know, how his dad writes the poems, and he recites them, and he writes some of his own, and I was like, wow, this is great.
Oh, now that's awesome. Terrific, because every generation worries, you know, that they'll be the last generation to revere and practice, whether it's, you know, reciting poetry, or there's been a wonderful revival in horse gear, in handmade horsehair and leather items, all wonderfully tooled and exquisitely wrought. So, but we always worry, you know, are these the last exemplars, or will we have another generation? So please encourage that 11-year-old.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And that's, you know, that's part of the reason. Well, that's a big part of the reason I do what I do, because I want to get this information out there to people and encourage people to do whatever it is that interests them within the Western culture, within the Western lifestyle, and you know, learn about cowboy culture. And I have, you know, I know several other people who are really committed to doing that as well. I don't know if you know Adrienne Brannon, Buckaroo Girl. She's been on the podcast, and she's amazing. And we had a long discussion about this actually, but you know, she's a young gal who's out there, you know, really sharing her stories through her music. And so it's people like that that made me think that it's going to survive.
I hope you're right. And many thanks. I sort of look at you and me, we're sort of cheerleaders for the Western, and I'm very proud to be that. So, you know, absolutely. But what you're doing is giving people voice to a larger audience. And again, this cowboy culture never disappeared, but it had no place to be made public until the last few decades of gatherings and song fests and so forth. So, and I'm very pleased that people are putting out, you know, CDs and DVDs and books. And so I'm an optimist about it, but I always worry a little.
Yeah, for sure. We wouldn't be doing it if we didn't. So I just have one final question for you before we wrap up here today. What do you think is the most important quality for any good cowboy to have?
There is, I think, a core. And if you want just one, I would borrow a phrase from a very prominent Western poet, ride for the brand. I think the notion of loyalty, that cowboys will do whatever it takes to take care of the ranch, the animals, the ranch family, their fellow cowboys. That kind of loyalty strikes me as certainly the most important, and the one that I've seen back to the 19th century, and it's just never disappeared. If somebody doesn't have that, they're going to go to town and become a banker or something, or do something else, but they're not going to be a cowboy.
Great answer. Well, thank you so much for being here today, Rich. It's been great chatting with you.
My pleasure, Alyssa. And I'll look forward to when we're coming up on spring break. I'll have a time to read more of your podcast or listen to more of your podcast. So looking forward to that.
Awesome. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I hope you enjoyed that interview with Rich Slotta. He had some really great insights on cowboy culture, and it was a lot of fun to talk to him. I don't know about you guys, but I think it would be really cool to attend his lecture in Fort Worth on Lonesome Dove, only one of, if not the greatest movie of all time. And I happened to notice recently that it's on Netflix, so if you've never seen Lonesome Dove, well, just watch it. And if you haven't completed the Earn Your Spurs survey yet, go to earnyourspurs.com/survey and fill it out. Thank you so much for being here and listening in. I really appreciate all of you. and I will see you next week.
Thanks for listening to the Earn Your Spurs podcast. Until next time, happy trails and spur on.